Thank you very much, Ken. It's a real pleasure to be here. I think I attended my first Philadelphia Society meeting in Chicago about 10 years ago. I've been off and on since then, and they've always been occasions for conversation, and as we saw this morning, occasionally the unexpected, too. I've entitled my remarks, "The University and the Culture of Teaching and Learning," and I want to have offer two caveats at the very beginning. The first is that I talk a lot about books, and while I talk a lot about books, by that I mean really texts, or even more broadly, artistic creations generally. So even though I say books, I think we can read or understand works of visual art, music, and so forth. The second caveat, which I guess was going to be a little bit more of a warning until this morning, and we had Sid Vicious, but since it's afternoon and you're all ready for a nap, I want to warn you that I began my remarks with a quotation from Michel Foucault. So, here we go. "The Temptation of St. Anthony is not simply a book that Flaubert had long dreamed of writing. It is the dream of other books, all the other books that dream and are dreamed, books that are taken up, fragmented, displaced, combined, cast away, set at a distance by the dream, but also brought closer to the imaginary and sparkling satisfaction of desire. With The Temptation, Flaubert surely wrote the first literary work whose proper place is the space of books alone. After that, Le Livre, Mallarmé, becomes possible. Then Joyce, Roussel, Kafka, Pound, Borges, the library is on fire." This vision of the consuming fire of the Alexandrian library is that of Michel Foucault from the introduction to a 1964 edition of Gustave Flaubert's The Temptation of St. Anthony. Flaubert's work is marked by desire, by a passion sparked by books, which in turn fill books. Lust is ignited and transposed as the imagination ranges within the space of books alone. What are we to make of the imaginary and sparkling satisfaction of desire? We, like Flaubert, like his creation Emma Bovary, lust for books. Are we similarly deceived in our concupiscentia librorum? Our satisfaction is not imaginary. We are not, or ought not to be, Emma Bovary. The love of learning finds its highest satisfaction as it is transformed in the intimations of transcendence. Books ideally raise us up. They expand not just our knowledge, but our humanity. They return us to reality with fresher eyes, with sharper and more supple souls. Any reflection on the university and the transmission of culture must be grounded in the culture of teaching and learning. This leads us immediately to a perplexing juncture. The most important things, as Augustine notes, as did Plato before him, cannot be taught, only learned. We put much faith in the great books tradition of teaching and learning, in which, in the presence of one another and a classic text, we learn about ourselves and our past, and so begin to unlearn the passing distractions of the present. Yet the faith in the great books can manifest itself as an overconfidence sometimes. Books can and do deceive. They help us to deceive ourselves. It behooves us then to revisit the idea of the classic text by looking briefly at two contemporary students of literature, George Steiner and René Girard. Both Steiner and Girard attend, though in quite different ways, not to the status of the classic, but to the external setting and the internal mode in which the classic is read. My subject, then, is nothing less than the external and internal structure of intellectual desire. Literary criticism should arise out of a debt of love. With these opening words to Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, an essay in the old criticism, George Steiner burst upon the world of literary studies. Literary criticism should arise out of a debt of love. This is a strange and wonderful methodology. Steiner's intellectual passion manifests an hostility toward theory. Far from an achievement, theory, in Humane Letters, he says, is nothing but intuition grown impatient. Steiner's own trilingual upbringing, French, German, and English, is in some sense emblematic of a more general suspicion of a narrow, monoglot spirit, whether linguistic or intellectual. A grateful wanderer, he says, I have sought to press on my students and readers that which is other, which puts in doubt the primacy of the household gods. Submission to theory imposes a false and impossible literalism upon a reality not amenable to oversimplification. The beauty of a sculpture often lies in the nonconformity of the shadows which rest upon its form. The polyglot multivalent character of what Steiner calls the classic opens rather than forecloses the possibilities of meaning. Far from being a body of conclusive truth, the Western literary or artistic or philosophical canon is a body of literature representing the highest level of human imagination and intellectual exploration. Steiner writes, I define a classic in literature, in music, in the arts, in philosophic argument as a signifying form which reads us. It reads us more than we read, listen to, perceive it. The classic will ask of us, have you understood? Have you reimagined responsibly? Are you prepared to act upon the questions, upon the potentialities of transformed, enriched being which I have posed? A classic articulates, then, it opens up a space for fruitful, if difficult, deepening of the soul. It is a space which demands a response. To read Plato or Pascal or Tolstoy classically, Steiner says, is to attempt a new and different life. Such classics question, dislocate the comfortable mental world we inhabit in such a way as to be, he says, unsettling, even painful. In responding, in engaging in reflective self-understanding through understanding others and classic texts, one entertains the possibility of being transformed in such a way that may translate into action. We do not open the book. It is the book which opens us. Confrontation with or immersion in a classic is not the occasion for arrogance, but of humility before sublime human achievement. Steiner writes, both thought, knowledge, Wissenschaft, imagination given form, and love ask too much of us. They humble us. The elitism with which Steiner is sometimes charged is an impatience with mediocrity as an offense to the possibilities of human excellence. While he decries totalitarianism, he notes that artistic achievement often flourishes under totalitarian opposition. By contrast, the de facto, as he puts it, censorship of the market over what is difficult and innovative, over what is intellectually and aesthetically demanding, weighs against artistic excellence. Like a passionate lover, he jealously guards those he loves from violence and compromise. Teaching, like love, is something that one falls into, is called to. Any attempt at serious thought, Steiner says, is a vocation. It comes to possess one like an unbidden, often unwelcome summons. One can, however, cultivate the possibility of that summons. A universitas worthy of the name is a place where the student, Steiner says, is brought into personal contact with, is made vulnerable to the aura and the threat of the first class. That is, the student is brought into contact with the classic. The encounters with excellence in intellectual and physical form are collisions which terrify. Excellence bullies, Steiner says. And they also inspire. The student, he writes, will forget neither their luminosity nor their menace to complacency. The terror and wonder of an institution teeming with first-rate minds, engaging the human highest human achievement, is not a gratuitous discipline, but a condition of passionate inspiration and an expression of seriousness of purpose. It happens to be blindingly obvious, Steiner writes, to me, that study, theological, philosophical argument, classical music, poetry, art, all that is difficult because it is excellent, Spinoza, patron saint of the possessed, these are the excuse for life. I'm convinced that one is infinitely privileged to be even a secondary attendant, commentator, instructor, or custodian in some reach of these high places. I cannot, I must not negotiate this passion. It is the teacher who can make the classic speak. More properly, it is the teacher who elicits the possibility for the classic to be heard. But here we must be careful of our terminology. It is now customary for professors to speak of teaching Homer, for example, to students. By contrast, up to and even after the Second World War, an Oxford Don would have said, "I am reading Homer with my students." This slight difference in locution betrays a profound difference in how education is understood. In the former case, the teacher transfers knowledge to the student, a transfer now not infrequently described as a transaction between the producer and the consumer of a durable good. In the latter formulation, however, the teacher and student are engaged in the common effort of reading a classic text together. The teacher may and ought to have greater experience and facility with the text, but both seek to learn from the text and from each other. The aim is not so much the transmission of data, but an increase in understanding as teacher and student alike place themselves as learners before the classic text. One becomes an apprentice to the past, a participant in a tradition, not in blind imitation, but in appropriating to oneself a practice to which one lends the stamp of a distinct human personality. Picasso did not innovate until he had mastered the classical forms. In René Girard's world, a classic could be said to shape the memory by revealing the reader's own propensity to imitate others. The classic uncovers idols, dispels them, while itself remaining transparent, resisting the temptation to idolatry. The dialogue with the classic becomes, thus, an exhumation of memory. Girard writes, "Recapturing the past is recapturing the original impression beneath the opinion of others, which hides it. It is to recognize that this opinion is not one's own. It is to understand that the process of mediation creates a very vivid impression of autonomy and spontaneity precisely when we are no longer autonomous and spontaneous. Recapturing the past is to welcome a truth which most men spend their lives trying to escape. To recognize that one has always copied others in order to seem original in their eyes and in one's own. Recapturing the past is to destroy a little of one's pride." Pride can survive, Girard writes, only with the help of the lie. A classic, then, does not simply represent the completely imitative existence of the passionate being. It reveals it, and in so doing reminds us of our responsibility both to think for ourselves and to abandon the self-deception of the imitation of others. As the past is recaptured, the soul's bondage to imitative desire is brought to light. The reader's investigation of the classic is transposed into an archaeology of his own soul. I am tempted to say that the classic peels back the layers of memory and liberates us from the imitation of others, that we may arrive where we started and know ourselves for the first time. We might say, then, that Steiner articulates the mode of reading a classic, Girard dissects its inner workings while revealing the fragility of the structure of intellectual desire and our propensity to misplace it. Both authors fear a misplaced imitative desire which seems especially modern. Girard writes, "Modern society is no longer anything but a negative imitation, and the effort to leave the beaten paths forces everyone into the same ditch. Reality springs from the illusion, and provides it with a misleading guarantee," Girard says. What does this mean for the transmission of culture in the university? I have several brief remarks, and perhaps we can talk more about the political and practical implications later. Politically, it means that it is long past time to pull down the idols of the age, to deconstruct the deconstructionists, to expel the household gods. The culture wars, it would appear, are over, or at least are carried on by other means. The battle for the canon has subsided to some extent, but that leaves space for the revival of the classic and for an ancient mode of teaching and learning to be recovered, exegesis understood as a practice of shaping one's soul. I suspect that American education, having encountered quite radical curricular swings, or at least pressures during the culture wars, is returning to a stronger commitment to fundamentals. The result is, nonetheless, not a recapitulation of the Western canon as traditionally received. The emergent feminist, minority, and other specialized studies have been largely metabolized in the body academic. If universities are increasingly revisiting some notion of a core curriculum, it would seem to take thematic form so as to encompass both canonical and non-canonical sources. This may, in fact, be good news for traditional or canonical texts and approaches. there are a number of practical trends which open up a space in the university for the transmission of culture. But more important is the cultural awareness of the students themselves. In contrast to recent decades, we may be well be on the brink of an age in which young people find, not lose, a sense of traditional culture in their undergraduate studies. If this is true, it is true in part because more and more students have less culture to lose. But it is equally the case that there is an increasingly cultural and institutional awareness of what we have lost, or at least that we have lost something. In addressing that loss, the contemporary university may paradoxically find itself embracing an ethos in which, while secular, is nonetheless not hostile to the enduring things of the spirit. In such an atmosphere, students will readily discern the depth of the Jewish and Christian traditions from among the din of materialism and the passing fog of superficial metaphysics. Before I conclude, let me give you just four examples of what I mean. Consider this from a student from India, a magna cum laude computer engineering major who took my honors seminar 2 years ago entitled Time, Memory, and Transcendence. He writes, an Indian computer engineer. Augustine's confessions do not merely amount to a soliloquy. Even though he seems like he is speaking directly to God, like one would in prayer, perhaps, one may see aspects of one's own self in these passages. If I really concentrate hard on his passages, occasionally I do get the feeling that it is I who is confessing rather than Augustine. A sophomore biology pre-med student in the same class wrote in her reading journal, I originally signed up for discrete mathematics, but instead took time, memory, and transcendence. I do not believe in God, but I have fallen in love with the poetry of T.S. Eliot. The final two examples come from a course series entitled The Odyssey of Freedom, which I taught under a grant from the Templeton Foundation Freedom Project. Consider this from a sophomore music major. Though it is true that it is a lust of the flesh that Augustine has lost in bridling before his conversion, pride's great cacophony lies in the fact that it aspires for exactly that which it can never be. Pride suffers, seek an undue godliness and a lust for domination. Such persons attempt an easier road toward freedom, but find instead a certain deterioration of the soul that comes with the inability to confront their past. Freedom, then, to Augustine, is an acknowledgement and embracing of dissonance, of sin past, present, and potential, so that God's will and ways may be understood and appreciated, and a resolution reached through praise to whom it is due. The final example is pithy from a sophomore history major who emailed me in some considerable despair 3 weeks into reading Tocqueville's Democracy in America. She wrote, I am reading Tocqueville and I see myself, and I don't like what I see. These are the reflections of students who have humbled themselves and allowed classic texts to read them. I have not taught them, they have learned, and as Augustine and Plato both insist, they have learned from that inner teacher. Such learning is, has been, will always be, more than the mere transmission of culture. It is the awakening in the students of a desire to explore the best of human culture on their own, for they have come to see how much the tradition has to teach them. The pedagogy of the classic may counteract the tendency toward negative imitation by revealing it, by cautioning the reader against illusions, misleading guarantees. But the classic does not do this on its own. We do not choose the classic chooses us and measures us according to the character of our fulfillment of the debt of love. And our success is measured not by mastery, but by the increase of discernment and of love we take away. Lust drives the insatiable fulfillment of possession. Love, on the other hand, delights in the evanescence of properly mediated intellectual desire. The classic may be servitude, the classic may be freedom, not according to its quality, but according to the quality of our desire. And since Ken mentioned memory at the beginning, I'll read the following stanza from Yeats' poem, The Circus Animal's Desertion. Heart mysteries there, and yet, when all is said, it was the dream itself enchanted me. Character isolated by a deed to engross the present and dominate memory. players and painted stage took all my love, and not those things that they were emblems of. These students have simply become initiates into a tradition of conversation and have begun to lend to that conversation their own distinctive voices. Culture has not been transmitted to them as to unsuspecting heirs who take delivery of a dusty attic trunk. Rather, the students have begun to clothe themselves in the rich fabric of an ancient and ever-changing culture, and in so doing, they give to that culture added color, vitality, and passion. They have been jostled from complacency and the imaginary and sparkling satisfaction of desire to a love of excellence and excellence's source. They have entered the tradition and found not the space of books alone, but a populated space of conversation which explores nothing less than the gap between time and eternity. Flaubert's Saint Anthony is a voice crying in the wilderness of Foucault's Alexandrian conflagration, but there thrives in the desert of that other Saint Anthony a bush which burns and is not consumed. Thank you.